If you guys will indulge me for a second.
Let's hear it.
We haven't really talked about comics in a while.
Oh, gosh.
Specifically comics of the era.
Yeah.
At the time, 2001, 2002. I think the last time we talked about anything, we talked about the 12, which if you guys remember...
That was a sword thing?
No, that was before the 12. We talked about it.
Right, but the 10 of Swords is a modern X-Men thing.
Sorry.
The 12 was a very late 90s, I remember it might have been 99 or 2000, event. It was a Apocalypse focus. Basically, it was this thing where Apocalypse needed to gather together these mutants in order to transfer his life essence into a new body. And he tried to take the body of Nate Gray, who was the offspring of Scott Summers and Jean Gray from the Age of Apocalypse timeline, who got time displaced. So Cyclops ends up interfering, saves Nate Gray, and becomes Apocalypse himself. And in between the 12 and where we are now, Cyclops gets totally removed from the X-Men landscape because he's like officially dead. Like they killed him off. Like Professor X can't find like a psychic presence of Cyclops. He's just Apocalypse now. He disappears. They do a flash forward in time. Chris Claremont actually returns to write the Uncanny X-Men, like the original X-Men book for a time. And he has a team with Cable and Jean, both on it. And Cable, as we know, is the offspring, another time displaced child of Scott Summers and Madeline Pryor, the clone of Jean Grey. We've talked about that. We won't go back into it.
How does it work with the Phoenix being one of the 12?
What do you mean?
Was the Phoenix one of the 12?
Yeah, it says here that the Phoenix is one of the 12, along with Cyclops.
Right, so the 12...
Oh, is this resolved? This has been resolved?
Yeah, the 12 is resolved. Once Apocalypse transferred his essence into Cyclops, 12 was resolved. That storyline's on. That was just the end goal, the end result. But then they go on this probably a 5 or 6 issue miniseries called Search for Cyclops, where they actually find Apocalypse, who's now in the body of Cyclops, and cure him. They drive the presence of Apocalypse out. But you know, there is like this long going psychic scarring that happens with Scott Summers because he was Apocalypse for a good while. Some other notable things that happen leading up to what I'm actually getting to. Colossus is dead, so there's an ongoing storyline in the 90s, the legacy virus.
Who teaches art at the school now?
Colossus again. We'll get to it.
Oh, perfect.
He's dead, but he's still teaching.
Right, Colossus doesn't stay. Like, he's got a ghost. He's a ghost teacher. So up until 2001, where we're getting to, the Xavier Institute is not like a school that you saw in the X-Men movie. There are the young X-Men who are being taught there are just the X-Men as we know them. There aren't like this mass student population at the Xavier School. Colossus dies because of the legacy virus. It's like a mutant virus that kills a mutant when they get infected. Kind of, I suppose, like mutant AIDS was supposed to be the allegory. And AIDS was always a pretty apt comparison because it was a disease thought only to affect mutants. HIV/AIDS was a disease only thought to affect homosexual men. So that was the thing that they were drawing. They eventually had to wrap up that storyline, and they did it. For some reason, it could only be cured. Like, Beast found a way to cure it, but in order to, like, metabolize the cure or something, someone had to like inject themselves with it and then die. Colossus, Ileana had died previous to this. His parents had died. He had no more living relatives, or so he thought. So he was like, I don't really have anything else to live for. He's stuck into Beast Lab, injected himself. They cured the legacy virus. Colossus is dead. And he'll stay dead for a few years.
Do they still, like, at this point in the comics, are they crying whenever somebody dies? Like, don't worry, we'll see him next week. It's fine. Don't worry about it. He got decapitated. It's fine. He'll come back.
I remember you joke about this with Banshee's daughter.
Right, Siren. So Peter David, who's really good, he in 2003 starts writing a new X-Factor book. And this is when Banshee dies and Cyclops comes to X-Factor to learn, hey, sorry, your father's dead. And she's like, okay. And he's like, no, seriously, he's dead. Like, yeah, but we'll see him again at some point. Like, but he's dead. Yeah, it never sticks. And of course it didn't. And Banshee eventually comes back, but because of an Apocalypse seed, so he's a bit evil now, but that's gone now. But he doesn't meet Siren right away, because Siren eventually becomes an old Irish goddess of death. neither here nor there, because that's in 2013.
I would think it would be easier to like think of characters in the X-Men comics that died and just stayed dead and didn't come back.
Well, what's
it'd be a much smaller list.
How many
restorations you got? Oh, three.
Ooh. I mean, that they got like a running tally, like tattoos on their arms. How many times they've been resurrected?
God. But isn't there one where Mr. Sinister like literally unexists himself or something?
That's not ringing a bell. But Sinister, isn't
there one where like somebody was like I don't know. You already are trying to.
We've derailed the shit out of you.
Yeah. No, that's okay. That's okay. So all of this is leading up to Marvel signs this writer to write the new X-Men book, and when his sort of proposal is like, okay, we're gonna sort of de-superheroize the X-Men, like kind of take the approach from the movie, where as opposed to having like these ornate, ridiculous costumes, they're just gonna be like in black leather. And sort of, mature up the look of it, I suppose, and sort of the tone of it. And this guy is Grant Morrison. He had previously only written for DC, wrote a lot of Batman, pretty famous for, in comic circles, pretty famous for the stuff he did in Batman. This is a big get for Marvel. They were really proud to get him on board. And he starts writing the sort of B-side of the X-Men book, is just called X-Men. You have Uncanny X-Men, which is the one that started in 1963, and you have X-Men, just the one that started in 1991 and was still going. He retitles it New X-Men. Something else that had also happened, just as he was starting to write for Marvel, is Chris Claremont, who we mentioned before, was writing Uncanny X-Men, the one that started in 1963. He was back on that book. He had written for that all through like the mid-70s up until like 1991. So they had him back, but they originally were going to give Chris Claremont this volume 2, the B-side, as well. But they got this golden boy from DC. Morrison. Yeah, they stole him away, Grant Morrison. So like, well, Chris, we'll give you something. We'll give you an own third title. So he starts writing Extreme X-Men. And Extreme X-Men, he pretty much like pulls all of his favorite characters. Rogue and Gambit, of course. Psylocke, he loves Psylocke. Beast, Sage, Bishop. I think that was pretty much the main team. And they're like, oh, and Storm. And they're like this world traveling team. They're off doing their own thing through most of the continuity at this point. But something that ends up happening is like...
They look fantastic. They're all matching.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's real good. But Chris Claremont gets to do like the weird stuff. So like they have adventures in the Savage Land. He brings back Rachel Summers out of sort of like semi-retirement. She was benched for a time. But Extreme X-Men will go on, and it's a wacky book. It's a lot of fun. And one of the first things he does, because they at this point they still care about continuity, so they're not going to have characters cross-pollinating between books very often. Wolverine's the exception. Fuck that guy. Grant Morrison wants...
Wasn't Wolverine like in Japan or something? Like being a detective?
Madripoor. But yeah, like an island in the Pacific.
Okay. I find it funny that typically like diehard X-Men fans hate fucking Wolverine.
He's such a clown. He is such a fucking asshole.
But yeah, anybody who's like a somewhat X-Men fan is like, Wolverine's so great.
Yeah, Mr.
Hugh Jackman. Yeah.
Mr. Pointy Hands. He's cool.
I never liked Wolverine. Like I never liked him.
The Hugh Jackman Wolverine is much cooler than comic book Wolverine. And like the transformation like happens when like Hugh Jackman is Wolverine. Like, okay, we got to make him cooler. Be like people liked Wolverine in the 90s. Because, you know, he's Mr. Pointy Hands. But neither here nor there. So Grant Morrison wants Beast for his title. So Chris Claremont's like, fucking fine. I'll write Beast off my book. And as I'm doing it, I'm killing off Psylocke. So Psylocke gets killed off. And Chris Claremont will go on to like introduce new characters that never pay off in X-Men continuity. Like they'll get created for his book, and then once he's done writing that book, they just disappear. They're gone forever, like heroes and villains. Some of them,
like that random guy who just made me think of the guy from Misfits. That what was it with his
lactokinesis?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he was the villain for the
finale. Lactokinesis.
Yeah, controls the milk.
Are you talking about characters like Lifeguard and Slipstream?
Just like them. Also, some villain characters. They're like supposed to be like these hyper mutants, more powerful than mutants, but yeah, they disappear quite quickly. One of them that sticks around is Karima, who is... you didn't mention about the... there's another character who will get named Thunderbird, named after a legacy character who died fighting a plane. We've talked about him.
Fighting a plane?
Yes.
I see there's also Lila Cheney in relation to Dick.
Lila Cheney! Yes! Fucking, but she... We don't get introduced to her until 2004 when House of M happens, or 2005. But I fucking love Lila
Cheney. There's so many things I want to derail you with right here. Just go on.
So
she's a fictional British rock star.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of Lila Miller. Lila Cheney's fucking great too. She's been around since the 80s.
I can imagine why Chris Claremont would create a character who's a British rocker.
Yeah. And she teleports, but she can only teleport in distances of light years. So she's an intergalactic rock star whose power comes in handy in really specific situations.
Couldn't she just... Yeah, wouldn't it be the same thing as, like, what Nightcrawler does when he just teleports somebody 200 feet in the air? Can she just, like, just teleport them light years away from the scenario? Yeah,
and then teleport back. It's like, well, everyone will be dead by the time you even make it a little bit closer to Earth. Grant Morrison wants Beast. So he takes Beast into his book, New X-Men. The Uncanny book... 1963 that's still ongoing is being written by this guy Chuck Austin. He's a hack. All that stuff should be ignored. It's garbage. Okay. But this book that started in 2001, in the summer of 2001 or late spring, New X-Men, really does a lot to change the overall X-Men landscape. One of the first things it does is, we've talked about the island of Genosha before, right?
Yep.
It's an island where mutants were treated as a slave race. When Magneto threatened to destroy the planet, the UN just gave him that island that was being ravaged by civil war. So it became the de facto mutant nation. One of the first things that happens is Xavier's evil twin, sort of.
God damn X-Men.
Gets a relative of Bolivar Trask, who is the creator of the Sentinels, makes a mega Sentinel from a master mold she finds in the Savage Land, and wipes out the entire mutant population in Genosha. 16 million mutants dead, and the X-Men still have not recovered from that. It's just like this horrible genocide, and it was like the first issue of this series that Grant Morrison starts up. So you get to introduce this character, Cassandra Nova, who's Xavier's evil twin, kind of. Emma Frost is one of, like, four survivors of Genosha because she was teaching on Genosha at the time. She joins up with the X-Men. And this is when Xavier outs himself as a mutant and actually starts up a school. So Emma Frost comes in to help teach at that school. Her and Scott will end up taking over once Xavier throws in the towel, as he does because he's a bitch. But like so many things change in this Grant Morrison run. You have like these mutant massacres. You have like actual like out mutant rights activists in the human community. You have like a re-emergence of a Sentinel program. One of the big things that goes on is you have a lot of these like more grotesque mutations. Like there are mutations. You see like the Morlocks in the 80s and the 90s as this group of people who have like these more like deformity sort of mutations, but Grant Morrison really cranks it up, and you have so some really like grotesque, depressing mutations that like happen.
Penis chariots,
yes. And eventually, like Grant Morrison he'll bring back Magneto as a character. He'll kill off Jean Grey again. She'll stay dead till about 2016, so she'll be dead for quite a while. He'll break up Scott Summers and Jean Grey. He'll break up their marriage because he's still dealing with the psychic trauma of being Apocalypse and has an affair with Emma Frost.
And she can't, like, see past that? I mean, oh, you were possessed by a...
Yeah,
Apocalypse. I think I could see past this for a moment.
There were a lot of things that Grant Morrison does in this book that they'll just immediately undo. Like he also like kills off Magneto, and then like a month later, after he's done writing this book, Marvel will, like, some other writer will come in, like, no, he's not dead. He's fine. And Grant Morrison, like, gets so mad that a lot of these things are undone that he'll say, I'll never write for Marvel again. And he hasn't. Because someone resurrected a character that he killed. Everyone does that. Everyone resurrects the characters.
Yeah, give it time. Like, not like a month later. Like,
a month. That's enough time. It's like, that's like an issue. It's cool. But yeah, really.
So aside from like getting the name, like, are they genuinely good books? Like, do people really like them?
Yeah, it's a really good run. I think it goes from 2001 to about 2004, I think, and it's a really good run. I'm not a huge fan of the art. Grant Morrison always works with, often works with a particular artist, and he like draws people with very long faces and really like pronounced like jaw lines. I find it. I find the art a little bit off-putting, but you know, it's a style. But it's considered a really good run. It is a really good run. The way it brings Emma Frost into like the main X-Men book. She had always been a character, like a villain character in the 80s, and then the 90s she was more of a redeemable character because she was a teacher with Generation X, which is a book that ended in the late 90s, early 2000s. But yeah, really, really solid book. Regarded as like a very like a maturation step with the way these books are written, tackles some more serious subjects. But yeah, super good. Should we talk about some movies?
I got a couple to talk about. Yeah,
let's do it.
All right,
kick us off. Where do we want to start?
I guess we can just go in order. I mean, I have them listed by when they came out. I didn't write down the dates, but you know. I got, how many movies do you have? I've got, like, 7.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so it's January, so, like, this is kind of a dumping ground for a lot of stuff. First one I got is a kind of an oddball one called Metropolis, an anime feature. Have you guys ever heard of this one?
Yep, I watched it.
Oh, you watched it? What did you think of it? Yep.
You know, I think,
Well, let's preface it by saying this. It is at the time, the largest budget ever given to an anime film, exceeding Akira, and it would be the largest budget until Steam Boy comes out in 2004.
I liked Steam Boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a loose telling of the events of Fritz Lang's Metropolis, which was based on a book. I mean, it's very much like a combination of Metropolis with Blade Runner and a ton of Art Deco retrofuturism.
Yeah, you definitely see the influence of Blade Runner all over this thing, and a lot of times with, especially Japanese video games. Specifically that deal with like sci-fi or the future, Blade Runner, the influence is all over those. I think that the weakest part about this movie is the narrative. There are just things that dangling plot threads all over the place. I think it has a real problem finding its footing to like, what is this movie actually about? Where is any of this going? Why does no one stop the guy with the sunglasses, just runs around with a gun? He like escapes apprehension multiple times, just shows up to fuck things up again. How come nobody's done anything about this yet? I think it has a problem establishing like a narrative momentum. But the positive things, I think it does have a really interesting art style, the way it sort of blends the hand-drawn animation with a lot of like the pre-rendered backgrounds. You saw like video games doing that as well throughout the late 90s and early 2000s, where you know you have like animated characters walking across backgrounds that were already rendered. But yeah, like overall, I do watch it in chunks because it was just really hard to get invested in the things that were happening because it would move away from characters and then like, oh, right, we introduced them, so let's go back to them, but I'm not even sure what they were even trying to accomplish. Specifically like the investigative reporter and his robot buddy. They were just kind of wandering around.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
they were a means of conveying us a narrative.
Right, and they, like the reporter specifically will have a function later on. Mm-hmm. It just didn't have much to do earlier.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's probably why the plot feels a little, like, it's hard to, like, even get invested in the plot, because, again, if you've ever seen Metropolis or you've ever seen Blade Runner, it's like, you kind of already know the beats. These are properties that are, at the times, 80 years old, and 20 years old. Like, these are well-established tropes that we're digging into here.
It's, Blade Runner probably still more in the zeitgeist than Metropolis.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen Metropolis. I don't know if anybody else has, but, like, I watched it for the sake of going back and watching some of the old films, and, like, yeah, it's a, you know, definitely taking some big beats from that narrative, and kind of dealing with, like, what defines humanity, you know, that's kind of a big overarching thing, is, like, when does a robot become human?
Mm.
Again, another thing that's well been versed in various science fiction films. And yeah, I think that as a narrative, it's a super boring story. The story is just boring, and it's hard to kind of just really get invested in the characters. But yeah, what really sells this thing is just these incredibly detailed environments. Just how much, like, again, it's like a Wilma Builder, or like a Where's Waldo painting. There's just so much happening in every single frame. It's gorgeous. The entire fucking movie is like it. It's like you could just pick any one quadrant of the screen and just look at it and just see all of this beautiful detail. Everything feels so lived in. And it could be like you're looking at a large building and then you're looking at like a little staircase on it, and the staircase has people in it. Mm-hmm. And then there's a thing attached to the staircase that's not just there to be there, but it performs a function for the staircase.
And there's a poster at the bottom of the staircase and a little shop with some glowing lights in it. And there's stuff in the shop.
Or it could even be the guy's desk. The guy's desk has all of this lived-in stuff. It's a little fan and a picture of his family and a cup that he has, and you can read the writing on the cup.
Every
frame is like that. It's just so busy.
It's very crafted. It reminds me of the Final Fantasy VII remake, because there's a specific environment, and someone took a lot of care into, like, I want this environment to feel this very specific way. I'm going to fill it up with as much stuff as I can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the characters themselves are very simple.
Mm.
They almost have like a what do you call it? Like a newspaper comic art style to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, like, 20s, 30s.
Right,
early animation kind of feel to them.
Right, right, right. They have the sort of like you were saying, like early 20th century sort of like apparel style and the way they interact with each other. There's like this whole like political drama going on with like there's a power struggle about who's going to like become the next mayor or person in control of the city. If it's going to be like a military dictatorship, or there's like just sort of a violent leftist uprising that's happening.
Like a captain of industry who runs the city, essentially, and then the mayor who wants to take power from him. And there's very much that upper and lower class, and then the robots are clearly the subservient.
Right, nobody likes them.
Yeah.
Nobody likes the robots.
And mind you, it's a fairly clean film in terms of, I mean, because again, like, the biggest one to this point is Akira, which is definitely not for kids. Definitely not a film for kids. But this one kind of is, except for, like, when they go after the robots.
Mm.
Like, you never see a human get mangled. But when they get the chance to fuck up a robot, it gets wasted.
Yeah, there's no, like, human gore.
Yeah.
There are a couple of times where, you know, there's some acts of violence, human-on-human violence, and you wonder, like, oh, did he just kill that guy?
Like gunshots, but with their cutaway shots, mm-hmm. and, like, you know.
You see someone hit the ground, like, but is he actually, like, there's no blood. I can't tell if, like, are we going to see you again pop up later? Is it the guy with the sunglasses? Because, yes, we will.
Oh, and his whole thing, yeah, about being, like, the son. And as I understand, that's the whole premise, right? Is that this guy who is this big captain of industry that runs the town. He has this son who is essentially his bodyguard, but then he also has this daughter that died, and he's been using this technology that he claims to hate to build a replica of his daughter. Again,
who's then
very Blade Runner-like.
Who's then supposed to, like, sit on the throne that will connect her mind. It's not like the internet or whatever, and she'll, like, transcend and become, like, this... a benevolent entity that's going to guide the progress of humanity.
Yeah.
And you don't really figure that out until, like, toward the end of the movie. Before that, like, up until about the halfway point, you're thinking, like, oh, this is like there's some sort of political unrest, and it's going to build to this point where they get caught up in this political unrest. And then it happens, and then that kind of just gets resolved with a gunfight and a bunch of people massacred, and then the movie just keeps going for another 45 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of a narrative, I mean, it's not a very good narrative, but I think just you got to give it props for being just like moving art. I don't know. You could probably have just as much fun with the entire 2-hour film just like controlling a cursor and then just moving through frames of it and observing this thing in motion that's so beautiful. But the story is whatever.
But to your point, there are some points of contrasting art style, which isn't bad. It's interesting because you do have probably the person who looks the most, I guess, like true to life is the robot girl, who's not an actual person.
Yeah.
Like all the human characters have like some sort of like exaggerated features. Like the Tony Stark of the movie has like the very like the yeah, parrot nose.
Yeah.
And like the mayor of the town is very short and squat.
Mayor. Well, and our red shirt shades guy, like he's built like Mega Man.
Uh huh. Yeah.
He's Mega Man.
It's and the part weird. In his hair makes no sense. There are times like it's pushed to one side, and then like he's clearly shot from the other angle, and you see it pushed to the other side. Like, how does this part even work? It's like curling across your forehead in both directions. It makes no fucking sense. But our protagonist, the young kid, who's retaining so much fucking water, like his limbs are fucking swollen.
Yeah. I don't know.
He needs to cut some salt out of his diet.
So yeah. I guess we're just good. This movie is also not successful. This movie made a lot more money overseas than it did in Japan, which is kind of crazy to think because this is totally their medium. But yeah, yeah, and I think that's probably why. Like, this is a very Americanized film. Mm. I think maybe people thought that they were going to make another Akira or something like Akira, and in a way, it is like Akira. I mean, it's a big movie where, like, a giant robot destroys everything and shit. It's kind of like Akira.
It's an Americanized Japanese remake of a German film.
Yes. Good way to put it. Good way to put it.
This Russian nesting doll of cinema that's with this, empty on the inside.
Again, loaded with this, like, Art Deco style. Like, which probably was not a very common, like, what did you just say, aesthetic.
Right.
In Japan, ever. Again, I don't know. It's a weird bit of history in terms of, as films go. Do we dare guess the budget for the most expensive anime?
I don't even know. I can't even. Oof.
I'll tell you guys, it's really low.
130 million.
No really way. Low? 40?
14.
That's the most expensive anime?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
$14 million is what they spent.
All right.
Again, anime is for nerds, dude. Anime is for nerds and clowns and virgins.
They don't pay their artists anything.
Box office.
Domestic? Are we talking domestic box
office? This is the global box office, man.
It had to have made its money back.
Yeah,
it made
14
money. I'll go higher. I'll go 25.
10.
Oh my god.
Oh my god. Oh,
what a train wreck.
What's the biggest anime that's ever come out? Like, I don't even know. Like, anime is not popular. Like, like globally, or certainly not in domestic box office.
I mean, yes, how do the Ghibli movies do?
How do they do? You tell me.
I don't think they do well, because they keep going.
Oh, look up Ponyo's
number. Although, I
guess Ponyo's probably their most successful.
Porco Rosso?
Yeah, Porco Rosso made $100 million. I'm fucking sure, man.
We do kind of a skewed perspective, because we do a fucking video game podcast, so, you know, we're a bit more
open to this kind of thing. Yeah. The shit that
Ponyo made $34 million domestically.
Banked compared to this movie.
Banked, yeah. How much do you think, like, Despicable Me 3 made? I bet it's, like, probably
$1 billion. Right? Gross.
So, yeah, that's kind of a...
I'm gonna
see how did Belle do?
I mean, yeah, like Belle's probably one of the bigger anime features you've had here in America.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the
frame. I thought it was okay.
I think we do have to like.
I liked it. That was good.
I think we do have to like probably like readjust our.
63 million.
Oh shit! All right, that was a lot better than I thought it would.
I think we have to readjust maybe our perspective when it comes to guessing box office totals for these anime movies, because it was 2002.
That is true. That is true.
It's more like widely accepted. It's more mainstream now.
Yeah. That is true. That's a very good point.
Not Despicable Me mainstream, but you know.
I mean, I believe Princess Mononoke was a huge breakthrough film.
I gotta watch that one American again. It's been a minute. I gotta watch that one again.
It's good.
That one, Nausicaa.
Mm-hmm. Also very good.
It's been a long time.
But yeah, like I think that's like when Americans think of animated films. It's sort of like that's cute. That must be for kids.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just an American perspective on animated films. I don't think that we take them as seriously as, or think of them in a context for adults. Probably like we think of soccer. Soccer is a game for 8-year-olds.
It is.
I wonder how many parents took their little little Timmy in to watch Akira. It's like, oh, that dude just exploded. All right.
I would hope that if your theater was cool enough to show fucking Akira in the 80s, that the guy working the box office would be like, maybe don't take your kid to see this one.
this pimple-faced dweeb. No, don't take your kid to see that.
Black Cauldron's in the other room.
No one saw that either.
Great Mouse Detective.
That's what happened with Sausage Party. A lot of parents took their kids to see a Sausage Party.
Oh, and no. I would think they left immediately.
God. Yeah, they probably, well, yeah. Yes, like, be like, oh, we were wrong. Let's go.
I work with a girl. Oh, she's in her 30s. But she mentioned in passing, like, the movie Sausage Party got brought up for I don't know what reason, but she mentioned in passing, like, oh, I had a first date with this guy who, like, took me to see Sausage Party. It was a terrible date. I was like, go on. Please tell me. And she got embarrassed and wouldn't say more. But
I want to hear that story.
Me too. I want to know more about this. Like, did you go on another date with him? No. Like, you need to...
Did you stay for the whole film? Did you watch the entire film?
I need a detail. She wouldn't tell me. This was like a year ago. It still bothers me.
I remember going to see Cosmopolis. But did we see that together? I don't know if we saw it.
We might have.
Because there was maybe like 10 people in the theater total, and I'm pretty sure about 6 of them left.
The movie's hard to watch, but not because of the proctology scene. That was whatever.
I remember 2 people distinctly left because of the proctology scene.
Because
it's Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
Like, at the peak of his, like, you know,
Twilight prowess.
Teen girl love of Robert Pattinson. He makes that movie.
Mm.
Wow. Should we move on?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to move on from proctology scene.
Orange County. Orange County comes out.
Oh, the Jack Black, Colin Hanks.
Yeah. I didn't watch this. I had no care to.
Neither did I.
See it?
I don't even know the movie.
Okay, it's directed by Jake Kasdan, who more recently I saw that he did the 2 Jumanji sequels. I saw one of them and I actually genuinely enjoyed it.
Hmm.
So this could be good. I just don't care about watching a coming-of-age teen comedy starring Colin Hanks.
Yeah, whatever.
And Jack Black is not a huge draw for me either. It's cool that he's there, but, like, I don't care.
Wasn't John Lithgow in this one too?
Probably. I don't know.
I think it'd be more intrigued to watch if it was the other way around, a coming of age story of Jack Black. And
so I think the general premise was, if I remember from the trailers, because I had like a VHS or a DVD of something around the time where this movie was, like, coming to home video and whatever form, there was always a preview, like, unskippable preview, so it must have been a VHS. Anyway, neither here nor there, because I remember seeing this trailer a bunch of times, and Colin Hanks is an aspiring writer. He wants to go to, I think it's Stanford. I was picking a writing school out of the air.
If you're in Orange County, Stanford makes sense.
And Jack Black is his, like, ne'er-do-well brother or something. And they get into, like, college hijinks together.
Sure.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Fuck this movie. It's probably dumb.
What was the budget? I'll tell you, it's not the most expensive live-action film ever made.
Is it going to be more or less than Metropolis?
I can't even...
14... I'll go 20 million.
I was going to go 15.
Kind of splitting the uprights, you two. I wrote 18. I don't know what it was exactly, but 18 million.
Okay.
Right. What do you think it made?
I think it probably got its money back.
25.
Go 20. I'll go a bit higher. I'll leave a gap, though. I'll go 35.
43. Oh, shit. Would you believe it? You actually did okay. Next.
All right.
We got Snow Dogs.
Okay. Good.
Snow Dogs is a Disney film, a Disney live action film. It's basically a fish out of water story where Cuba Gooding Jr. has to, like, do something with sled dogs.
Do you think this killed his career? Because I don't remember him doing anything after this.
You know, it was kind of like that Pearl Harbor followed by this.
It's a big shot to his credibility, but not his box office draw. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Okay. Because I think he did, like, with that Men of Honor movie before, maybe after this, I don't know.
Yeah,
I think he maybe picks wrong projects. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, I think this was a bad step. I mean, he shouldn't be that ashamed. It's a live action Disney movie about fucking dogs. Maybe he made it because thought kids could watch it in a movie.
Are they in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere?
I did not watch this movie. I do not give a shit about this movie.
Detroit.
I don't care. I don't care. They're in the Amazon. They're fucking snow dogs in the Amazon. It's, no, I don't know. Actually, I really have no idea.
Snow Dogs on the Moon.
I think you can look at the cover art and tell the narrative.
So we're gonna guess the narrative. We're gonna guess the narrative of Snow Dogs the movie. So Cuba Gooding Jr. He is not a professional dog slayer. He's a total amateur. Never done this before in his life. Okay. He needs to get something. He needs to run the Iditarod as an amateur dog slayer with this team of dogs that doesn't like him at first, because they can tell you're not a slayer. We're the professionals here. You're the newcomer. And by running this race with these dogs against all odds, because the dogs are so good and he opens his heart to trusting them, they win the race. And he becomes a better person. And they become better dogs.
I'm hoping something along the lines like he was a successful businessman, but then something happens and gets sent to like Alaska.
Yes.
As a pet, like you fucked up. Now you have to be. Yes. Now you have to run our Alaskan.
He got caught drunk driving. Now he has to coach the dog sledding team.
I don't think they're dog sledding team. I think it's just how he gets around town.
He has to coach the dogs.
And he has to do like a delivery service to the
will
houses.
You let me remake the Mighty Ducks, you motherfucker.
So here's
dog.
Yes.
I didn't watch the shit out of that movie.
I've spent as much time as you spent talking about it just now as how much time I've spent reading the plot. Okay. So I hope I get this correct. He is a dentist from Miami.
We were way off.
Who was adopted. And is told...
By dogs.
And is told that he is going to get his, like, his biological mother has passed.
Oh no.
And in order for him to go claim her and his inheritance from her,
oh shit, I remember
he has
this.
To take Siberian huskies across Alaska.
Oh shit, I remember.
In doing
this.
So, he finds this guy, played by James Corburn, named Jack Johnson, not the boxer. And then, like, gets through some series of events, he ends up getting submitted into a dog racing thing for him. called the Arctic Challenge, and everybody dies in the end.
Oh, fuck. Even the dogs? No.
The entire Earth. I hope. I don't know. I didn't read the end.
All right.
The movie is so bad, the entire planet just gives up.
Budget.
Oh, God, it's a Disney movie.
Yeah. Am I going first? I think I'm going first.
Okay, you go first.
Budget. I mean... Any movie around water costs a lot, and this is frozen water. I don't know if that counts.
Can I tell you, the director of this is a guy named Brian Levitt. Two diverging paths about him. One, he made Jingle All the Way.
Oh, amazing.
Oh, shit.
Perfect film.
He is also responsible for the film Beethoven, and Max 2, White House Hero, which is also about a dog.
Oh, interesting.
So he's really good at directing dogs.
and Jingle All the Way had that reindeer.
Yeah. Oh, it's your dad. They're like dogs of the North. budget. I am going to say this movie cost $30 million.
Okay. Oh no. I was gonna go like 50 or 60. Like this,
do
is,
it.
This is 50.
Oh, close. So close. 33.
Yes. Wow. Well, all right.
33. What do you think it made?
Did this movie make its money back? Is it a Disney movie?
Yeah, it's a Disney movie. That's making. It's January.
No, I'm gonna be bold. I'm gonna say no. $20 million.
I'm going to go 60.
Oh, you were way off this time.
Damn.
No, and that's not 60 either. 115.
Oh, my God.
There wasn't... I mean, there
was
probably...
What was wrong with us?
There was probably still some good stuff from, like, December in the theaters, but I think this is probably your first, like, real movie to get you through January in the box office.
That is depressing.
Yeah. Not a good one, but there it is. Moving on?
Yep.
You have.
I think we've got as much out of Snow Dogs as we can.
I think we got more out of them than they did.
So now you have, I believe, what is the 8th feature length attempt at telling the narrative of Count of Monte Cristo?
Oh, sure. I know this movie.
Yeah. It is made by Kevin Reynolds, who, hey, you know, he's responsible for, at the time, the most expensive film ever made, Waterworld.
Very good.
Also the director of Waterworld. So what is it? This is a my little hit piece on this is that it is a streamlined effort to tell the 1,000-plus page narrative of Count of Monte Cristo, which is an 1800s epic about many, many things, including the downfall of Napoleon. But it's largely centered around this narrative of Edmond Dantès, this guy who gets fucked over, who's trying to get revenge on these people by pretending he's someone else.
Yeah, a few of his acquaintances frame him for a crime, and he gets locked away, even though the people who are locking him away are kind of aware of the situation. Like, yeah, we know you didn't do this, but somebody's gotta, so it might as well be you. So he gets locked away for a good portion of his life.
Yes.
Eventually, is able to break out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like the book follows him more of like this seafaring adventures that he goes on for a little while before he returns to his homeland to exact his revenge.
Yeah, and I think it actually does the film favors that it is trying to tell a very simplified version of the net simplified version of it, but a focused version of the story centered around the one character instead of like literally one of the side characters. I was just reading the plot synopsis of the entire kind of runner. I did not listen to the 53-hour audiobook
or read
the 1,100-page book. So, yeah, like, I know that there was a giant chunk of the story that's dedicated to a villain in this is time in the Napoleonic Wars.
Hmm.
Just fucking telling you about that. A guy that you hate and are happy when he dies. So, at any rate, great cast. I guess we'll start with the fact that it's got QAnon acolyte Jim Caviezel as the lead character. I really... For Jim Caviezel hasn't done anything evil like beat a woman or like kicked a dog, but as a QAnon supporter, I think this guy is a total dirtbag.
Yeah.
A real piece of shit. But he plays the main guy, Edmond Dantès. It's also got Guy Pearce, who is his best friend that fucks him over. James Fran, who is the inspector, essentially, that sentences to life in prison. Luis Guzman, who is a ne'er-do-well that becomes his sort of best friend and kind of co-conspirator. Richard Harris, who was the guy that was the original Voldemort, or not Voldemort, excuse me, the original Dumbledore before he passed.
I was about to say, we don't say his name.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And he is the prisoner, he is his co-prisoner that sort of trains him and prepares him for a life of civility.
Yeah, it gives him like
fencing
training and also just like lessons in society and sciences, turns him into a gentleman while they're in prison together.
Yeah, like, he can't even read. Like, the reason that he gets in trouble, too, is basically he's asked by Napoleon to give a letter to somebody. A letter he couldn't even read. But he, you know, that's sort of what gets him wrapped up in this whole narrative. Oh, and lastly, you've got, not lastly, but Henry Cavill plays his son. So it's very cool to see Jim Caviezel and Henry Cavill because I feel like Henry Cavill stole all of Jim Caviezel's roles.
Good.
And Dagmara Domic. As Mercedes is the woman that was his love that he tries to win back. That's really good. It's actually a very enjoyable movie to watch. You gotta love the comeback narrative and seeing how he kind of fucks everybody over individually. Kind of gets his, you know. There's a fucking quote. What is it like when you go out for revenge? Dig two graves. It's kind of that sort of thing you see with this.
Yeah, because eventually he's he doesn't need to exact all his revenge to get his girl back. He just kind of needs to show up and reveal his identity.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually he has to make the decision, like, do I actually want to get the girl back and be able to live out the rest of my life, or do I want to continue to pursue the people who fucked me?
Yeah. So, and again, it's about 2 hours long. It's not a very lengthy film, so don't feel like you've got to embrace this whole epic. I mean, they could have easily made this a mini-series and made it 8 hours long, but it would have been for the worse.
Mm.
Genuinely enjoyable. I like this one, and I think if somebody wanted to, you know, like, see a, you know, faithful, legitimate telling of the narrative and not something like the fucking Disney Three Musketeers, you know, you got this.
How dare you, sir? How dare you besmirch the good name of Oliver Platt, you motherfucker?
I recently watched that. I will besmirch all day.
No! No!
That movie is
They're all doing flawless French accents.
Nobody's doing accents. The only people that are doing accents are the ones that take their jobs seriously, which is obviously not Oliver Platt or fucking Kiefer Sutherland
just
or fucking Charlie Sheen.
Just the female leads in the movie. They're the only ones who are doing accents.
Oh my god, and how
Charlie
bad?
Charlie Sheen was in that
movie? Yeah. Who's the main guy in it? They played Robin in the...
Chris O'Donnell.
Chris O'Donnell is just terrible at everything. He doesn't act. Yeah, he just is there. You get the sense that with the Chris O'Donnell performance, is there's a guy off screen holding a cue card? With the words he's supposed to say.
No, I'm very familiar with this adaptation of Three Musketeers. Me and my brother watch it a lot as we were young children. The Chris O'Donnell character of D'Artagnan, like, things just kind of happen around him. Things are happening, and he just finds himself in the middle of it constantly. He's not actually moving any of the action forward. He's just there.
He challenges all three men to a duel to the death simultaneously.
Three grown men who are very good with swords. And he's just like, yeah, I beat up some local schoolyard bullies once. Mm-hmm. I can stab them. I'm ready to murder. Oh, my God. that's kind of Monte Cristo.
I kind of want to watch this movie now. Not count.
Oh my god, Three Musketeers.
You've never seen the Disney adaptation?
I have. Oh, okay. I have. It's just been years. I don't remember Charlie Sheen being in this movie.
Sting does the theme song for the movie. A really inappropriate theme song for what the movie actually is. It's a song about fucking. And it's this kid's adaptation of Three Musketeers. Anyway.
I'm sure it was the backup song he had for Emperor's New Groove.
I was about to say, damn it.
Oh, what a time to be Sting.
Count of, what do you think a movie like Count of Monte Cristo cost to make? And mind you, there was a scene where he flies into this event on a hot air balloon.
Yeah, I think this one was a pricey one, but you're going first this time.
Oh, 50.
50 million? Or $50?
$50.
I'm going to go higher. I'm going to leave some space. I'll go 60 million.
35.
Okay. Ooh.
Pretty Brit. Like, yeah. I mean, if you watch the movie, there's not a lot of huge...
But it had Charlie Sheen in it.
No.
Oh, okay.
That's Three Musketeers.
Okay, that mixed up now.
This one had Jim Caviezel, who would later be struck by lightning trying to portray Jesus Christ.
Seems appropriate right. For the kind of person he is.
Next.
Nope, he got off easy.
Next. I don't even know if this one was worth mentioning. I just recognized...
How much did it make, though?
Sorry. It cost $35. What was the box office?
Wait, am I going? You're going first.
I love how into this you guys are.
There
are stakes.
Shit. I'll go 80.
Ooh, I think it's a really good guess. I am going to go lower. I'll go 70.
75.
Oh,
bite to the death.
Split. Holy shit. I'm going to give me that bottle. I'm going to break it and stab you.
It's a plastic bottle.
I'll find a way.
Yeah. It's going to treat you like a sea turtle with that thing. All right, no.
Fuck.
And by that, he means I'm going to romance you.
All right, moving on.
You romance sea turtles?
Oh, yes.
We stop talking. We're moving on.
Yes.
To a film called Kung Pao Enter the Fist.
Oh, right.
Oh, I remember this one.
This is made by a guy named Steve Odenkirk, no relation to Bob Odenkirk. He does, however, work a lot with Jim Carrey, especially on Jim Carrey's earlier films. So, seems like he helped him a lot early on in his career with things like, Ace Ventura.
Mm-hmm.
So, expect the guy trying to basically do his shtick.
It's got to be silly all over the place.
Really offensive narrative of a white guy trying to do karate.
Really?
Yeah, that's what this is about, as I understand. Okay. I didn't really look into it at all.
Okay.
Oh, he wrote, directed, and stars in it. He produced it. So this is his little baby. One of the worst. If there will be a worse movie that comes out, I haven't seen this movie, so I can't say for certain. But I'm fairly confident that there will be one worse movie than this one this year. But wow, this is a year. You know how sometimes we're like, this is a year that had five movies that could have been the best movie. Mm. This is a year that has at least two that could have been the worst movies ever made.
Oh, amazing!
So.
I can't wait to find out what the other one is.
Kung Pao Enter the Fist.
I know nothing about this movie. Yeah. I've seen the box art, and that was all I need to know. To say, like, I'm never going to watch this.
I don't know, 15 mil?
I'm going to go lower. I'm going to go 5.
10.
Again? Oh shit! Wow. If we can make this happen one more time, it means something.
This is an unrounded number. If you guys can split this box office, I'll be shocked. What is the box office?
So it costs 10 million.
did cost $10 million.
Wait, am I going first or are you this time?
I don't know. I went first there, but it doesn't.
Okay, you go first again. I already think I know what I'm going to guess.
I'm going to 15.
I don't think this movie made its money back. $8 million.
Ooh, 17.
Oh, fuck.
So it made a little bit of money back, but not a meaningful amount. Okay, one I know you watched already.
Yeah, $7 million's not a meaningful.
Yeah, The Mothman Prophecies.
Yes.
Okay.
I did watch this one.
Pronounced Mothman.
Mothman Prophecies.
The Mothman Prophecies. So made by Mark Pellington is the director of this film. What do you think?
This is not a movie that you probably think it is.
Yeah.
Going into it because you
think like, it's about moths.
Even like the first few minutes of the movie, I guess the general plot setup is Richard Gere and his wife, played by oh my goodness. What's her name?
Julia Roberts.
No. from
Will. I wrote down some names in the cast, but I did not.
From Will and Grace. Oh my goodness.
Oh, yeah, that chick.
It's going to come to me at some point in the discussion here, but they are a married couple. I guess like they're trying to like portray them as a young married couple, but Richard Gere has never looked young in his life.
Deborah Messing.
Thank you. They get into this car accident. She has this vision or hallucination of something that looks like a moth creature flying at their windshield. She panics while she's driving the car, swerves, hits her head. She ends up in the hospital, and they find a brain tumor. It's terminal. She passes away. And that's the beginning of the movie. And you think it's going to be about him, like, unraveling this mystery about what is the Mothman. He ends up in this town in West Virginia. And
based on real events.
Okay.
Based on a true, or I mean, a believed urban legend out of Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Right. So he ends up in this town where they've also had these encounters. And you think it's like, okay, well, he's going to try to unravel what this thing is, how it is that it affected his deceased wife, and kind of get to the bottom of it and expel this curse from this town and from existence, from the earth. And it just kind of turns into like his own descent into a state of madness.
Oh, and keep in mind, years pass. Obsession. Like 6 years pass. His wife dies, and then, like, a lot of time passes, and then he just stumbles back into this thing that leads him down this journey of revisiting the experiences his wife had and determining whether or not they're real.
Well, it kind of, like, turns into, like, the Mothman, like, some sort of a supernatural entity, which calls them on the phone and will give them these sort of vague descriptions of events to come, and what it is they can do to prevent the thing that is going to happen, or how they get people to believe them. Him and like a couple other townspeople have had these encounters with this character, and I don't know. It was just very strange because I could never really figure out where it was even going. Like, what were the stakes of this movie as you're like in the middle of it? Because you're getting some creepy phone calls. All right, just don't answer the phone. I don't know. It was very difficult to figure out like what he wanted to get out of it, like what was his goal. Anyway, what did you think?
I think to answer that question that he always had was like, you know, was what was going on with his wife real, or was she just having these visions, these terrifying visions because of her tumor,
right,
or whatever.
As far as we know, she had like the one, and but then like in her hospital bed, she did some drawings as well.
Right. I mean, again, like if you want to get into what the narrative is, I don't think the narrative is particularly that like meaningful. Also, having just seen like Jeepers Creepers is sort of what this movie thinks maybe you're going to get into, but you don't, because Jeepers Creepers is about a moth-like thing that's just brutalizing people, just murdering the shit out of people and like ripping their flesh off and stuff. Very grotesque. This is a psychological thriller where it's all about the mind and what the mind can create. And I think that if you want to just go straight to the punchline ending, I feel like that whole ending is just so perfunctory. It feels like it's obliged to give the audience that kind of ending, and it's a stupid ending.
Right, they needed to have some sort of spectacle there at the end.
So yeah, they have it be that the Mothman itself is a doombringer, essentially. It foretells doom. It's not necessarily causing anything or intentionally trying to create harm, but when the Mothman starts to show up, it's because a tragic event that's going to take a lot of lives will occur. This is a very... I have to bring up Pokemon. I don't know if you guys remember, I asked you, or I mean, I had one of your Who's That Pokemon questions I gave you was about Absol.
Right.
And it was something like, Absol often shows up before natural disasters, which leads people to think that it is responsible for the natural disasters. Mm. It's only trying to warn people. So the Mothman, in a lot of ways, is Absol. Mm. No, but it is that. It is trying to just warn people of a terrible event. And in this case, you know, he thought it was going to be some, like, power plant having a bad disaster. And
right.
There, no, it was just that a bridge was going
to
collapse.
Yeah, there's some red herrings where, you know, you think, like, okay, it's leading to this tragic event, and there's, like, a governor of a neighboring state, I think the governor of, like, Virginia or something, is coming over to visit this chemical plant to celebrate petroleum, which hasn't aged well. But then when you think it's, like, leading to that, like, this is kind of a letdown, like, this is the event that is leading, like, a politician that we've never actually seen on screen before, you're trying to save him, who gives a fuck about him? And then, like, it's weird because an anonymous bridge collapsing, like, it manages to be just as much of a letdown.
Yeah. I think that I liked the idea of where this film was going more than the actual payoff at the end of it. I actually have a lot of positive things to say about this movie. I think it is like David Lynch made an episode of The X-Files.
Mm.
I think that at its core, this is the fodder for a 42-minute episode of The X-Files.
So since this is actually based on a local legend or whatever,
yeah.
The fun thing I found here is the source of the legend is believed to have originated from sightings of out-of-migration sandhill cranes or herons.
Okay.
That's probably what it was.
Not moths at all.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, just that's all I would say is that, like, this is very much a Monster of the Week X-Files kind of scenario. But it's really elevated by this director, Mark Pellington, who constantly gives you these fascinating shots. There's this guy clearly is putting a lot of thought and effort into how he's going to frame everything for you in this film. And I think it looks great. I think he does a lot of really interesting stuff with the camera. I mean, that scene in the hotel when he's talking to the Mothman on the phone is totally washed out with light. It is surrounded by blackness except for him, the bed, and a little light going down on the phone that he's talking on. That is the only thing, and then just without that, it is pitch black surrounding him. Little moments like that, or like how he chooses to put a camera, or he keeps it in motion but keeps the camera behind something, he makes you feel like you're the voyeur. He makes you feel like you're sneakily watching this guy. I think there's just a lot of really, really interesting stuff about the way it's shot that makes this so much better than what it really is when you break down what you're watching as a movie.
And I think you're right. Like, if you are just doing a 42-minute episode or something, if you're trimming out the fat, because there are a lot of things in this movie that don't go anywhere. It just kind of wanders and never arrives.
Well, and, like, there's the whole narrative around Will Patton's character, and Will Patton fucking is great in this movie. I think he does a great job of kind of watching him slowly lose his mind. That ultimately leads to his death, too. I mean, he just basically wanders off into the woods and accepts his fate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, really poor guy. You feel bad for him, and because you kind of also see him go through that same psychosis that his wife went through.
Right, and then there are certain things that don't pay off that you could accept them as, like, these strange things that happen if you're watching something shorter, but when you're watching, like, a feature-length film where, you know, you're expecting some sort of catharsis at the end of it, it just becomes an annoyance. Like, he sort of goes into this fugue state and wanders around, ends up in West Virginia when he's trying to get to Virginia. So he ends up near the Indiana border, and, like, okay, well, what happened to him during that time? Like, is it going to happen again? But that plot there just kind of gets dropped. When the character you're talking about dies of exposure, the coroner is like, oh, it looks like he's been dead for 8 hours. Like, I talked to him on the phone an hour ago.
Yeah.
That doesn't go anywhere. I was texting you guys. I was watching this movie. Like, Deborah Messing just showed up. Bet this goes nowhere. And it didn't. And those sort of things, like, if you're doing a 50-minute episode or something, and you can just have weird things happen and just kind of like builds toward like the mysteriousness of it. Cool, that's totally fine. Yep. But you know, if you're trying to have this complete narrative where the show isn't, it's not just about weird things happening. Like you're trying to tell this journey of this character as he descends into psychosis.
Yeah.
You kind of have to pay these things off.
And also, I don't want the movie to end this way, but this is also a scene in which like a giant mechanical thing is ripping apart with tons of people on it, and this was their opportunity to go ship. Or go Final Destination and just mangle some corpses.
Like, I showed restraint, didn't they?
At least it's something. It's the kind of ending that's like, ugh.
Well, that movie sure ended. Do we get the credits yet? Let's get out of here.
Oh, okay. I don't even know if I want to get Olive Garden as a feature. But it's like, you know, it's something. It's at least something. It feels so kind of stupid how it ends. I feel like they could have done a really cool, deep psychological thing. Mm. Again, maybe like What Lies Beneath. I think What Lies Beneath is a really interesting psychological horror film that, you know, has a better narrative and a better twist ending. And just has it's just more inviting. And I think that this is sort of kind of laconic and wants to be just very laid back and chill. So
maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's why the dangling plot threads bother me so much, is because I was looking for punctuation on certain things. And maybe they could have like left no punctuation and it would have been totally fine. But what they chose to go with is a big exclamation point at the end when, no, this movie didn't need or deserve a big bridge collapse.
It even gives us some sentences at the end. Don't you hate when a movie does that? It's like, we're going to give you a couple of sentences explaining where it's like, you know, well, so-and-so's life was fine after this, and no more sightings of the Mothman in Point Pleasant, but Mothman has recently been spotted here. It's like, oh, fuck.
In man. Detroit!
Yeah, in Detroit, he was shot to death.
Perfect. That's a better movie already. We've done it.
One more movie. Budget. What do you think of
movie? I think I'm going first this time.
Sure.
They did have to collapse a bridge or make it look like they were collapsing.
That was clearly a miniature. Go on.
They had to collapse a miniature bridge. $12.
They went to the fucking hobby store.
I don't think this movie cost a lot. Maybe. For $25 million. I don't know.
I was going to go 20.
Do it. Go 20.
Do it.
Go
20.
All right, 32.
Okay.
Oh.
A lot of very similar budgets. 33, 35, 32. But at any rate, what did it make in the box office? You got big names. You got Richard Gere. Oh, Laura Linney. We didn't bring up how... Just Laura Linney, great actress. You are not a small town cop. Mm. You were just shit in this movie.
Did not buy her that role for a second.
No, she is not nailing that one. But okay, sorry. Big actress Richard Gere is in this one.
I think it made. It probably made its money back.
Okay,
I'll go $40 million.
53.
Ooh.
55.
Oh shit! Nicely done.
Yeah,
well done.
So one last movie, just to kind of take a cheap shot at.
Perfect.
We've got A Walk to Remember.
Oh, that came out in... Okay.
Yeah, made by this guy Adam Shankman. It's based on a Nicholas Sparks book. Nicholas Sparks wrote Dear John and Notebook. He makes very sappy melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very sappy melodrama. It stars Shane West and Mandy Moore. It's one of those manipulative narratives about someone having like terminal cancer or something.
Yeah, I remember this being a popular movie with the teen girls, sad teen girls.
Yep.
At the time. And then the book as well. But Mandy Moore has a terminal illness.
Yes.
And has this starts this relationship with
the male. One of the troubled kids.
Shane West.
Shane with Shane West.
One of the troublemakers.
And they know from the start that she's got a terminal illness and they decide to get married anyway, and he watches her die.
Yeah.
And everyone's real sad about it.
Yeah. Two interesting people are in the cast that I like a lot. One is Peter Coyote, who it's
an amazing name.
God, that's so good.
Oh, he's got a wonderful name. He narrates the Ken Burns documentaries.
Oh, nice.
I'm not sure. I'm probably not every single one of them, but he narrates the vast majority of them. Has America's voice about him. Just an absolutely beautiful voice. Love listening to him talk. I have no idea what he's doing in this movie, but he is in the cast.
Getting a paycheck.
Also, an actress I haven't seen too much from lately, but Paz de la Huerta. I like Paz de la Huerta. She was in Boardwalk Empire. She's I'm trying to think of what the other one that I saw her in. It was Neon something, but at any rate.
Neon Demon?
I don't think it was that. Maybe it was
Neon know. White?
No, that's a video game that I enjoy, but that's they're pretty cool. She was there. No, but yeah, just interesting people in the cast. This movie looks like it's manipulative and schlocky garbage.
Yeah, without a doubt, this is like The Notebook, just intended to just make you just feel really devastated at the end of it. And all right, you did it.
Yep. Budget of $11 million, and it box office made $50 million. So it made its money back, but it's not a huge success. It shouldn't be.
How dare you, Mandy Moore?
How dare you, indeed.
I'm just joking. She seems all right.
She made Saved. Saved is fun. She's evil.
Oh, I remember that movie.
Yeah.
So.
You told me this was going to be a short one.
Yeah, I did, didn't I?
What happened to us?
Then we got to
derailed so hard.
What do you think? Okay, so if we're going to trim the fat here, do you think we should have not done Snow Dogs? Do you think I should have stopped talking
about Snow Dogs? Snow Dogs was gold in this podcast.
I think this episode is perfect the way it is. Okay, we're talking about a Nintendo game. And then Rift. Next up, we'll talk about exclusively Nintendo games on the next one, because we'll preview all the fun stuff coming out in 2023. We'll probably talk a bit about Fire Emblem, because that game will be out by the time we record. Well, maybe not. Depends on what record schedule we go with. Anyway, but we'll spend some time looking at the year of 2023.
So early in the month, though, we only get the official show left?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the last one. I mean, we can always like pivot and do something else if we have some extra time to record. Because when we start up again in February, we'll do a Pokemon show. We'll get back to a mini show. We'll get back to the tier rankings, which would be great. We get to jump back into those. And if we have like some extra time and need to do a filler show, we could just do another tier ranking show.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Because those are always fun.
You're.
But that's it. We're done here. The end.
So long.
See ya.